Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's Deep Dish Podcast. Subscribe today and tell a friend about Deep Dish Podcast with Tim Powers. With Tim Powers.
Hey, welcome to Deep Dish Radio. I'm Tim Powers, and you are on my podcast yet again. Hey, if you like what you hear on Deep Dish Radio, we would really appreciate your support. Tweet it out. Tell a friend. Go to our Facebook page, our Facebook fan page, which is Facebook.com/Deep Dish Radio. And, of course, our Twitter feed, @Deep Dish Radio. And write it down. Tell a friend. Tell everybody you know. We could really use the support. And if you like what you hear, email us. Our email address is ddr, that's for Deep Dish Radio, ddr@email.com. Pretty clever how we did that, huh? Tell everybody you know to go to deepdishradio.com and to check us out on iTunes, wherever we are. Hope you like what you hear. I'm really excited for today's episode. My guest today is the leader of a band considered to be the godfather of punk, which is quite a feat considering their formation predates Beatlemania. Larry Tamblyn started the Standells in Southern California, and after a little trial and error, broke the charts with the legendary single Dirty Water. You know it, you love it. Two more top 40 hits followed, Sometimes Good Guys Don't Wear White and Why Pick on Me, both favorite songs of mine. For over 50 years, this band kept its grungy, punky sound going and delighting fans all over the world. I saw them play live in 2009, and they rocked as good as ever. Whew. Now, after two CDs released in the 21st century and a backlog catalog that'll kick your ass, the Standells are gearing up for a huge world tour. Larry Tamblyn joins me today to discuss the past, present, and future of the Standells. Deep Dish Radio. I was 16 in 1985, and at that time, Rhino had put out the old Nuggets LPs on cassette, and you guys were all over those. And I got Try It and Why Pick on Me, and I'm like, these guys get it. And I started to research the fact that, you know, of course, this music was 20 years older than I was, at the time, but I mean, you got it. And it was just the soundtrack of my life. And Why Pick on Me was in the cassette deck of my first car for probably the first 3 years of its existence. So it is.
Well, that's Rhino. Actually, they put out about four Standells albums,
right,
in the 80s, and you know, they even had the Rarities album, which were a lot of songs that were previously unreleased.
What's the status of those albums now? Are they currently in print?
I don't. They are, but they're. I think they're done. Universal, MCA Music owns all of that, all of our catalog, and so they licensed it out. you know, and so there's all these different labels that are getting licenses on these products and in various configurations. So it's hard for me to keep up with them.
Sure. Well, I would imagine. And, you know, some of it's available by digital download and some of it's, you know, being printed. And I would imagine at some point somebody's going to remaster everything on vinyl like they do with everybody else these days.
Well, that's funny. That's funny you should say that because it was all originally done in vinyl.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm well aware. But, you know, I don't know if you're aware or not, but the kids are getting into vinyl again.
Oh yeah, I know that. It seems to be quite the rage, very well, and it seems to be a growing market too. However, we've got two new albums out, and neither one of them have really gotten into the vinyl thing. I don't know why.
Well, let's backtrack and talk a little bit about the history of the band, which is fantastic. But I absolutely want to give a lot of attention to what's happening now. Cause like I said, I saw you guys in 2009, at Amoeba for the Rhino box set. And, and you guys just blew, frankly, in my opinion, blew everybody off the stage. But,
thanks.
And it was so cool. And, you know, I remember going through the autograph table and being that 16-year-old kid again, standing in front of the standells going, "Do you guys know what you did for me?" But let's back up. You were 19 and you started this band and you end up doing a gig in what I believe was a house of ill repute in Hawaii. Can you back up and tell me that story a little bit?
No, not exactly. No, it was a nightclub.
Okay.
It was called the Oasis Club, and it was owned by Bill Pacheco, who was a football star at UCLA. It was,
right.
We call him Bill the Knee, and because he kicked the field goals, and he and his wife opened a club, and it was in Honolulu, and. And they brought in, you know, groups from the mainland, and we happened to stumble into a gig there because we hadn't formed the group that much, before that. And this happened to come open, and they booked us over there. But it's funny you should say House of Ill Repute because there was a lot of things that went on there that would lend itself to that that description.
Because it wasn't just bands, right? You were playing in between strippers and comedians.
Well, yeah. The way the show went, you know, they had it was like a burlesque, you might say, in which they had comedians, they had. Chorus dancers, they had a singer, and they had actors come out and do skits and things, and then the stripper, his name was Mickey Moto, and then we came on after Mickey, and it was quite. Being 19 years old, my first time away from home, I got to say it was quite an adventure.
But and you were playing quite a bit. The band was pretty new, so to run a parallel, Honolulu was kind of your Hamburg.
Yeah, the band, the original members were me, Tony Valentino, and another guy named Jody Rich.
Right.
And another guy, Benny Hernandez, which he was about 15 years old when he went over there. And we were all young, except for Jody. He was older than the rest of us. And I came up with a name because we did a lot of standing around booking agent's office and Standells, and that's how it came up.
Right. It used to be Larry Tamblyn and the Standells, and then you just became the Standells, right?
Well, it was actually opposite. We started as the Standells, and then when we left Hawaii, then it became Larry Tamblyn and the Standells. they figured they had a better chance of booking the band. And since I was the lead singer and it made more sense. Also, the guy that was, I wasn't the leader to begin with, Jody was.
Right.
He was this Napoleonic type of guy, real short and claimed to be a former Marine. And really, it was like boot camp with this guy. I mean, he made us spit shine our shoes, and we had to, iron our clothes, and whenever we went out, we had to dress alike, and like in uniforms, and we had curfews at night, and the guy, he started really going crazy because he was married and the rest of us were single, and he got really jealous, the fact we're, right there, we lived there, right there on Waikiki Beach, and we're picking up on all the girls, and so that's why he imposed the curfew, and so then he started, staying up all night, taking Benny's, and we'd get up in the morning, this guy would be all bug-eyed and say, "Hey, I got 200 songs for us to learn," and I go, "What?" Yeah, and, because I'm the lead singer, too. Yeah, how the hell am I going to learn 200 songs, And he was going pretty nuts, and finally, I just said to him, I said, "Look, anyway, I'm not going to deal with this, I'm not going to deal with whatever you've got going on, And so he got mad and he fired all of us, and by then the drummer had left. He had harassed him so much, the poor kid,
right.
Benny, he went home to his parents and in tears, and we had to hire the drummer from the band, from the house band. And he was a really good musician, and he fit right in, actually, except for he was a lot heavier than Benny, and couldn't quite wear his jacket. we had uniforms, yeah. but we continued on, and that's when the Jody started firing everybody. But then he realized they didn't have a band, and so he kind of eased up, but we were there for maybe about 6 months, and it was just like, living in paradise, a bunch of young guys living in paradise, we had a lot of fun, and then when we got back to the States, we parted ways with Jody, and then we reformed the band, and that's when we called it Larry Camblin of the Standells. We brought in Gary Lane and Gary Leeds.
Right.
And Gary Leeds, of course, went on to form the Walker Brothers later on.
Right.
And interestingly enough, the act that we're on, that was on, I could talk all night about this, but the act that was there at the Oasis Club before the Standells was John and Judy, John Moss and his sister Judy, and when Gary didn't know him at all, but they met later on, and of course Gary and Scott Engel were part of the Walker Brothers,
right?
It's just amazing how small the world is.
Yep.
But anyway, it went on as Larry Camblin for quite some. Larry Camblin of the Standells, and we toured up and down, and up and down, I shouldn't say toured, because we played in clubs up and down the coast of California.
Right.
We played in Eureka, we played in, Sacramento, and a lot of places up and down there along the coast. And then in Hollywood, we played at this nightclub in Hollywood. And
was that PJ's?
I'll never forget that one.
No,
this was before PJ. So we were playing in this club, some place on Melrose, and I can't remember the name of it, but I still was not 21. I think I barely turned 20.
Okay.
And the undercover police came in, and they wanted to see our IDs. And we would have been a shitload of trouble if we had, because, so was the club,
Right,
so
right.
I told the cop, you know, I said, you know, I didn't bring it, but I am 21, you know, and he says, well, I'm going to be back in a few days and I'll check it. And, Tony and I had to, go down to, this is the shoe story. We went to, drove to Tijuana and, got a fake, Social Security card for me. And then I typed in, we didn't have computers back then, but
right.
I typed it in with a typewriter and I put some phony address on it. I don't know why, but I did. And I claimed that I was from Ohio and I put a small O instead of a capital O in there and really screwed it up. But from a hand's distance, it looked authentic. And then I took the card and rubbed it in the dirt and rubbed it all over. So it looked that I had been, you know, used for a long time. And several days later, these cops did come back and he asked to see my ID and I was just shaking. I was so, oh man, was I. I was paralyzed almost, because he had told me, you know, originally, he says, well, come clean now or it'll go a lot harder on you, like they always do.
Of course.
And so here I was, you know, with this fake ID, you know, and I showed it to him and he just glanced at it. He says, yeah, I thought you were 21. Nobody would go this far. And that's the truth. And so we played in that club and then, more, you know, up and down the coast. And
this is about 64, 65?
Yeah, this is 1963. And then we started getting better gigs.
Right.
And it wasn't until, I think, early 1964, late 1963, I've got it here that we changed the name back from Larry Candlin on the Standells. It went from one L to two L's. We found out during this time there was an amplifier by the same name. We didn't even know this. And so we put two L's on there, and that's how it became the Standells. So it was Larry Candlin and the Standells. We recorded several records that were later released on Farrell Records. Linda Farrell, owned by Eddie Davis.
Right.
And I was with Eddie Davis as a single artist, and I had several recordings out before the Standells. And so he recorded the group, not much happened with them until, of course, we signed with the label, and then he released them. You know, we signed with Liberty, and he released them. One of them, I just there was a couple of them that came out as Larry Campbell, the Standells, but one of them in particular, The Girl in My Heart,
mm-hmm.
was one of them. And the other one was Someday You'll Cry. Now, this, I'm not quite sure what happened, but it came out as Larry Campbell and the Standells, and then we signed, like I said, we were signed with Liberty Records,
mm-hmm.
and then right away we had some television shows come up, and movies. The first movie we did was...
Get Yourself a College Girl? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was a trip. You know, here we were unknowns practically, and we were building the thing, you know, along with Dave Clark Five, and I think the Animals were in it. But they were, all their footage was shot over in Europe, whereas ours was actually filmed on the set and in Hollywood. But the biggest thrill for me was meeting Jimmy Smith, the jazz organist,
because yeah.
I just worshipped him. I thought he was just the best. And he's really what turned me on to playing organ. And So, and I actually played him in B3 in the movie that he played. So my fingers were just, I couldn't even wash them afterwards.
Such a great sound, the Hammond B3. What do you think it was? What do you think it was about the Standells at that time that made them, you know, television and movie friendly? Because at the time, you know, you could throw a rock down Sunset Boulevard and hit 10 bands. What was it about you guys, you think, that set you apart?
Well, you know, shortly before we started, we did our first film, we had a changeover. We were finally at PJ's, and our drummer quit us, Gary Leeds quit us, and he came up with this cockamamie story that he was drafted or something, and he has formed the Walker Brothers, and they had this big thing with their... Gary was just a tremendously funny guy and just an oddball, but I really loved Gary dearly.
Mm-hmm.
And but he wanted us to change our name for one thing, and we had already built up this reputation as the Standells, Larry Damlin Standells, but he wanted us to change our name to the Children. This is the honest to God truth.
Right.
Because he had seen this movie called Village of the Damned. All these kids. Yeah, nobody knows about this. He saw this movie called Village of the Damned. All these kids had blonde hair, and they had these superpowers. They're you know, from seeds from aliens.
Right.
And if you remember it. And so he was insistent on us doing this. And I said, no, we've already got a name built up. We're not going to change our name, you know. And so he quit the group and did almost the same thing with the Rocker Brothers. They dyed all their hair blonde, or they bleached their hair blonde when they first came out, and they all legally changed their last names. And this is all because of that movie, the Children.
Children of the Damned. Unbelievable.
The Village of the Damned. Yeah, and they had quite a bit of success in Europe, and a little bit of success here, but the biggest amount of success was in Europe. And,
right.
Gary has been a good friend over the years, and but anyway, to go on that when when he quit, and we auditioned people, and you know, I had always wanted a drummer who could sing, because I was really influenced by groups that had drummers that could sing. It was originally the Four Seasons, and that's what I liked about them so much, is they were a rock group, and the drummer sang from behind the drums. And that just didn't happen. And so I always wanted somebody that could do that, and we auditioned several drummers, and came across this kid, Dick Dodd, he was a former Mouseketeer, and he got a lot of... He came up, and we razzed him a lot about that, you know, and, you know, a lot of just really, really bad jokes, you know, about Annette and all that. and Cubby. But anyway, he sat down behind the drums, and it was just incredible, you know, and then he sang. It was even more incredible, and I said, gosh, this is great, you know, and so we added him into the group, and so he was with the group when we started doing these films, and, you know, Get Yourself a College Girl, and then, of course, the TV shows. I'm trying to do this all in sequential manner, but Dick was with us for just a couple of weeks before we recorded our first album, which was live at PJ's.
Right.
In person at PJ's.
In person at PJ's.
In person at PJ's. And the only, it was a great album, but the only problem with it was the producer, Dick Glasser. And I'll tell you this, to this day, the guy did not know anything about rock groups. He might have known about pop and stuff, but he thought it would be more exciting to speed the entire recording up, you know.
Right.
And in those days, you couldn't, you know, when you speed it up, it sounds, you know, and I'm singing, I'm doing most of the singing, it sounds like Mickey Mouse singing, you
right.
know.
So it raises your pitch.
Perfectly on that. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm singing, the best things in life are free. And I'm the best things in life are free. You did everything in me. You know, so by the time you sped it up, you know.
Right.
And so They later slowed it back down, and they came out with a re-release of it called The Standells Live and in Person, or The Standells Out of Sight, I should say, Live and Out of Sight.
So they,
and,
it was they released speed corrected our, then.
Yeah, that was released in 1966, of course, after Dirty Water hit. But that's how it went, you know. And Dick really worked out well in that he began to sing more and more of the lead, and we kind of it got to where we were singing each doing about half of the leads, and then we left Liberty because we didn't like Glasser. We left him, and we got more of this, and we went signing with BJ Records. And I know you wanted to know about this.
Yeah.
BJ was a tremendous rhythm and blues label, you know, and they had a tremendous, I mean, to BJ, BJ Records, you know, and they also had this unknown group called the Beatles.
Yep, that's true.
They didn't do a whole lot with them until after they, of course, you know, like us, you know, broke through Capitol and MI. They just, you know, they were in a, I think they, what happened with BJ, in my opinion, is they moved too quickly. They were, I think, back in Philly. I don't know where they were out.
Philly or Chicago, yeah, and they just grew too fast,
yeah,
huh?
They moved, you know, to some big offices in Hollywood, and they made too fast of a jump, and we were only with them for about 3 or 4 months, and they went bankrupt, basically. They had we recorded some stuff in the studio, and then they put us together with Sonny Bono.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, if you listen to a couple of recordings, like The Boy Next Door.
Right.
What Have I Got of My Own, I sang both those. Sonny produced those. Cher sang in the background along with us. They were really good friends. But, you know, Sonny had his own style. And he was a protege of
Phil Spector.
Yeah. And he had that wall of sound,
yep,
thing happening, and he tried to make the Standells into like the Righteous Brothers. You know, we just were. You know, we were a funky rock group.
Yep.
So we never did quite find ourselves, our true selves until we met Ed Cobb.
What was your sound like? What was your sound like before Ed Cobb? I mean, from Hawaii till now, you know, are you playing kind of a blue-eyed soul thing? What is your sound up to that point?
We got criticized for doing cover records, but everybody did cover records back then. Even the Beatles, you know,
right,
that's what you did in clubs. So that's nonsense. But we did all blues songs. We did Chuck Berry songs. Songs like Money and Johnny Be Good, we did the Four Temptations songs. So we were kind of into to rock and blues, we also did the Isley Brothers Shout.
Right.
That was a great song. We did a similar song, in fact, when we first signed with Liberty, that was supposed to be just really raunchy, like Shout. And Dick Glasser took and turned it into, I would say, almost into a polka. you can believe this. You remember that song, Shout, how
sure,
wild it was with Joey D and the Starlighters.
Mm-hmm.
It was supposed to be like that with a wild B3 going on and everything. And he brought in other musicians into it, you know, and actually we worked with, like Glenn Campbell was in it. But then he had a clavinet doing the lead in it.
What? A clavinet?
Yeah, clavinet, you know, and it just ruined the whole thing. And then he had doo-wop singers in the background. We didn't even do our own background singing in it. You know, he had, ooh, wee, ooh, wee, ooh, wee, you, we never would have done that. You know,
right.
This is Dick Blasters. This is his contribution to the thing, and he ruined it, I thought. But that was our first recording, was called The Shake.
Okay.
And that song was in turn, we redid it for the movie Get Yourself a College Girl, and they wanted something to do with the new dance craze, The Swim.
Right.
So we changed the lyrics and re-recorded the lead on it to The Swim. So instead of they're shaking in the east, they're shaking in the west, they're swimming in the east, they're swimming in the west.
Wow.
So that was changed, and so it's basically the same song. But anyway, we finally got with, you asked, you know, what was the group, what kind of group were we? We were a funky rock and roll group, you know, and we had producers that were trying to change us into other things, you know, Sonny into, you know, the Righteous Brothers and Dick Glasser into some pop, configuration. And it just wasn't us. So, when we met Ed Cobb, one of the things we liked about him was the fact that he just let us be us, you know, and he recognized us for who we were,
right.
Not who we wanted us to be. And we really liked that, and he acted, as a fifth member rather than, dictatorial at first. Now, he had this song that he wrote, supposedly. Now, we never got this from the horse's mouth, but it was based on an experience he had. He was in Boston, we know that.
Right.
But according to some rumors, he got mugged there, and he wrote the song about it. And I don't know if that's true or not, but that's according to, some rumors we heard. But he had the song. It was just like a 32 bar blues song. It had really nothing to it, and we weren't that impressed with it. And then with Ed trying to sing it, you know, he was one of the original four Preps, by the way.
I didn't know that either. Wow.
You didn't know that. Yeah, yeah. And, he had a very legit-sounding voice, so we weren't that impressed with it. But I said, Ed, yeah, we'll do it, but let us take and arrange it the way we want, and come back to you and see what we can do with it. You know, so we did. We took and added the guitar riff, and he picked Dick to sing, which was fine with me. I mean, I wasn't territorial,
right?
But. He picked Dick to sing this, and once he picked Dick to sing, then Dick was the lead singer in most everything except for, you know, a few songs that I sang, like Mr. Nobody and St. James Infirmary and, some of those. But
right.
Anyway, Dick wrote a lot of the lyrics in that, a lot of the asides, like, I'm going to tell you a story, it's all about my town, I'm going to tell you a big fat story, baby, it's all about my town. He wrote that. He wrote a lot of the throwaway lines in it, but they're cool people. And that's what made the song what it was, you know, and then I didn't do that much, but I did change the chord structure. A bit. Instead, any musician would know what I'm talking about. Instead of a straight seventh, it was an extended seventh, which gave it that just slightly different sound.
Mm-hmm.
So we came up with this and we recorded it. It was recorded on three tracks at Armin Steiner Studio.
You did all that with three tracks?
Yeah,
so what'd you do? Just bounce them back and forth?
Yeah. Oh, you know what bounce is.
Yeah.
not many people know what bouncing is.
Sure.
Bouncing is, for the audience out there, is when you record something on one track, you play that track onto a second track, and you record a number of things with it.
Yep.
And that's what bouncing is. And then you bounce that back to another track and add some more stuff. And that's the way it was done back then.
I've worked on my share of four-track analog machines.
Yeah. I mean, four track was a big deal,
yeah.
But there was three track. It was Armin Steiner's, it was actually a garage studio, and thus Garage Rock, of course.
Oh, I'm so glad you got here, because I wanted to ask about this. I wanted to ask about this studio, because it just sounded like the most amazing, like, bootleg, jerry-rigged place there ever could be to record a rock and roll album.
Yeah, it was. It was a funky place. I mean, he had a nice home in West L.A., very, very nice home, and it was in the back of his home and in his garage.
Right.
And it was unfinished. I mean, there was fiberglass on the walls. There was I don't think there was any air conditioning in it. It was like, you know, being in a gymnasium, you know.
Right.
But he did have a separate he did have a separate room for recording.
Okay.
And there was glass in between, so it wasn't that basic, but it was still a garage, and there was no acoustics up or anything. And the thing about recording back then is you either had the sound then or you didn't have it. You couldn't go back and add effects in or anything else. That was it.
Right.
And so so it was recorded on three tracks, and we recorded everything, all the instruments on the first track, and then we bounced it to the second track, and Dick played the mallet on the bass drum. That's how you had that heavy bass drum sound, which was very unusual back then.
Cool.
You just didn't have it on the record.
And it worked so perfectly for AM radio, where that bottom is there.
Yeah. Yeah, when it was instead of just a one and three, it was a doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. He would do that, and along with the pattern that Gary played, it worked perfectly for that, you know. And so that's where that is, you know. And also on that second track, Dick added the tambourine in, you know. So, you know, and then finally the background vocals and then the voice. So, so you had this, it took us, it took us a couple of days to do it.
Right.
And we liked what we did, but we never would have thought it would be, you know, such a big record, you know, and we recorded it, you know, and continued playing in clubs and basically forgot it.
Right.
And we were playing up and down in San Jose, and that was when Dick first quit the group too. He quit it a number of times.
Yeah, there's a San Jose story I want to hear, but we'll get to that. Where but Dirty Water comes out, and it's a regional hit on the other side of the country from where you're playing, right?
Yeah, I mean it took almost 9 months. Between the release and when it was picked up on this small radio station in Orlando, Florida, of all places, and went to number one there, and spread into Miami, and went to number one there, and then it started spreading pretty quickly up the coast and around the country. It was I read where it was one of the longest running records on the charts.
Nice.
Of a record that year. It showed up as the highest it went on Billboard was number 11. But that was, you know, spread over, you know, like about a 7 or 8 month period. And the Cashbox had listed it as number 8, and Record World listed it as number 1. So there was quite a disparity on how they did the accounting on it, but it didn't get airplay in a lot of the same places at once, you know.
Right.
And I think California was one of the later places to pick up on it.
Interesting.
And Boston as well, they didn't pick up on it right away.
and you still hadn't played in Boston, right? I think the first time you guys played Boston was when you opened for the Stones in 67.
That's right. Yeah, when we opened for the Stones, and that's another story. But getting back to the San Jose story, this was before Dirty Water hit, and it was just beginning to get played in WLOF in Orlando. And Dick had quit the group because he didn't think we were going anyplace. And he joined this group, I think, called the Ravens. And we brought in Dewey Martin, who later, you know.
Joined Buffalo Springfield, right?
Yeah. I love Dewey. He was crazy. I just loved him. He had a pet ocelot that he took with him every place. And he and I roomed together, you know. And he left that cat, you know, and they're. I mean, they're beautiful creatures, you know, but he left it in the room, and the maid went in there, and I heard her screaming at the top of her lungs. And he didn't attack her or anything. He just
scared
saw him and screamed. But Dewey was great, and he even recorded the original voice on Why Did You Hurt Me? That was
that's Dewey?
One of our first recordings. Yeah, it was no. He originally recorded it, and then Dick wanted to come back because he heard that, you know,
Cool fact: a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You had a hit.
The director was climbing the charts, so he wanted to come back to the Standells where the bread was. And so he came back to the Standells and unfortunately had to let Dewey go. I just love Dewey.
Sure.
But
he did okay.
They erased Dewey's. He did great. And I don't think he ever got the recognition he deserved afterwards. But, you know, that's another story.
Right.
But anyway, Dick, you know, re-recorded it. They put his voice on it. So that's what happened. So that's Dick's voice on it. Why did you hurt me?
But in San Jose, when you were playing in San Jose, Larry, you were playing in kind of a rough spot, and weren't there? I think the story is that there were some Hell's Angels in the bar where you were playing.
Yeah, there's a big Hell's Angels chapter there in San Jose, and that was their hangout, and they claimed it as their own, you know, and every night just about there were fights in there, and I became friends with the one guy who was the president of the chapter. He gave me his business card, and his name is Fuck Up.
Yep.
That was his name. It said Fuck Up right on his card, you know. And he said, "Hey, if you ever get any problems with bikers, just show him this card," you know. And years later, I actually did. I got, you know, almost got mugged by a couple of biker chips. Chicks outside of this recording studio,
right?
And this was in the late '60s, and man, they were big chicks, you know, and I didn't know what to do, and then I thought of his card. I pulled it out, and they just got down on their knees, or in awe that I had Fuck Up's card. So that was my get out of jail free.
Gotta love it.
He really liked me because there was a big fight one night, and some guy was trying to hit him from behind with a beer bottle, and I called his attention to it, and he turned around and clobbered the guy before he could hit him.
So
I was his buddy after that.
You gotta love it.
Anyway, these are all true stories. They could only happen with the Standells.
No kidding. Hey, I want to talk about Try It. Which is one of my favorite Standell songs, but it ended up getting banned in Texas and a few stations around the country. Even, I think, if I remember right, it got banned on KHJ, which kind of gave you a little underground credibility, I think. But did it, you know, it hurt sales, but it helped with your counterculture credibility. Can you talk a little bit about Try It?
Yeah, that was one song that we all thought as soon as we recorded that it was going to be a hit. And in fact, Billboard magazine picked it as a number one hit.
Right.
And everything looked that way. And it's right about that time, Gordon McClendon, owner of KLIF in Dallas and programmer of a number of radio stations across the country,
right,
started this committee in trying to clean up record lyrics. And, you know, at the time, I mean, the Stones had Let's Spend the Night Together out. I mean,
yep.
John Denver had Rocky Mountain High, I think, but he picked on the Standells because he knew that we weren't as big as the Rolling Stones.
Why pick on you?
Yeah, why pick on us? That was our story. It's true. We got refused admittance at a hotel because of our long hair one time. They were really anti-long hair. I mean, it was worse than, I love black people, don't get me wrong, but it was worse than being black back then.
Wow.
In the South. Yeah, you go into a place, it's like a scene out of Easy Rider, you know, where it would just become quiet, and then somebody would like that, and
right.
And there would be giggles, and, you know, we had one woman put a soap band around my doorknob. She figured, she found out where we were staying and picked, you know, my room and got a soap band, you know,
yeah,
inferring that I never take baths, you know, and put it around my doorknob. So I found out where she was, and I got a band from a stack of $10,000 bills and put it around her doorknob.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the Standells' attitude.
Yeah. And I knew it was this person because, you know, the outrage when she saw us and everything, and I knew who it was. That's the kind of stuff we ran into. But getting back to this, try it. Gordon McClendon decided to start this campaign, and he picked on Try It, you know, which was, in my opinion, still today, it really had nothing to do with the lyrics, although he claimed it did. I mean, the lyrics were, by the way you look, I can tell that you want some action. Come on now.
Yeah.
Action is my middle name. Come over here, pretty girl. I'll give you satisfaction. But tour needed for this game. I'll give you sweet love you've never had before. Come on. Yeah. He really made a national campaign against this. I mean, he went on news stations around the country, showed our record, and said, you know, this is a perfect example of what we're talking about. It encourages young girls to have sexual intercourse.
No.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And
they certainly weren't doing that before the Standells, were they?
Yeah. Oh no, they would never think of that.
Right.
No.
Sure.
Back then, you know, they had the petticoats and what else? Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
But anyway, they, you know, we were on Tower Records, and we thought, God, what a great publicity thing to do is to sue these people. We could sue them in court, for liability, for, you know, for all sorts of things, for damage, for, you know, because in essence, when he came out and did this, we were guilty, until proven innocent, and all of these stations that were playing the record stopped playing it, including KHJ, and the record was number one on KROA, and KHJ wouldn't touch it.
Unbelievable.
And I was that way in a lot of radio stations across the country, but the end result is that the record bombed because of this, and I think that had we have been with a stronger record label. They were scared to death of this man. And I think we have been with a stronger record label that we could have done something with it. And I also think that they made a deal with the devil, so to speak, because the next record that we released was Can't Help But Love You. And McClendon stations played the hell out of that song, and it actually reached the charts. It was number 74 in the charts.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that in the mid-60s, mid to late 60s, that disc jockeys were somehow being encouraged to play certain records? Wait a minute. Yeah. I've never heard of such thing.
No, that never happened. But we think that the record company, and I have no proof of this, we think they made a deal with McClendon. Okay, yeah, we'll go easy on this. We won't do anything if you play the next, if you really pounce on the next Sandell's next recording.
Right.
And as it turned out, this Can't Help But Love You was a good song, but it was quite a departure from our sound. It was a rhythm and blues sound.
Yep.
Had horn section in it, and this is when Ed Cobb started really getting full of himself too, and he wouldn't even let some of us play on the recording. He said, well, it was a bunch of black musicians in there. And he said, well, these guys sound more like the Standells than you do. And I said, well, how can that be? Yeah, they're like horns and saxes and rhythm and blues people, you know. And the two guys that actually arranged us, Ethan and this other guy, were also R&B people. They were friends of Ed. And so that was the next song that they went on, was this thing that was quite a departure from the Standells, more rhythm and blues than anything.
Unreal.
And it went so high, but it certainly didn't, it didn't go as high as what could have happened with Try It. But that's the way things go, you know,
right.
And that really, I think, that was the beginning of the end for the Standells. I mean, even Art Linkletter heard about this. So you heard about that story.
And he had you on the show, right?
Yeah, he had us. He had a show back then called The House Party, and this is the last couple of years of the show. He started this debate format segment within the show called Let's Talk, and he'd have different factions debating each other. And he had the Standells on with debating McClendon.
Right.
John Fleck, who is still with the group today, he and I did our homework on this on McClendon. You know, we were in Texas for a while, and so we dug up a lot of stuff on him. And this man was, I can't mention a lot of the stuff, but he was an absolute hypocrite. You know.
You don't say.
Yeah, like most of them, you know,
you
just follow the pointing finger up the arm and you see where the real scumbag is. Anyway, so they had us on this debate with them, and we just massacred them. I mean, we massacred them. We couldn't bring out a lot of the stuff, but some of the audience's members were, it was full. It was done at the Hullabaloo nightclub in Hollywood. That was the old Moulin Rouge, later became the Aquarius. You know where that is?
It's the Nickelodeon Studios, right? Not Gower, but what's the other one? Right between Vine and Gower on Sunset, right? Across from the Palladium?
I can't remember, but it was right in that neck of the woods.
Right,
you know?
Sure.
It was on Sunset, it's kind of near Vine, is all I remember. And they had it in there, and it was stacked full of teenagers. I mean, it was just filled to capacity with teenagers, you know. And some of the audience members were fed specific information about McClendon. And so every time it looked like he would almost get a point in, which was very rare, somebody from the audience would yell out something like, what about the baseball games, McClendon? They had a deal where they were, they faked baseball games. They had they pretended like they were at a major league game, and they pretended, they made it seem as though they had a play-by-play announcer there. They actually had somebody that was there that was spotting, and they would call in as the plays were.
And they'd fake the games live on the air, huh?
And then there'd be a guy there with sound effects and crowd and everything, and announcer, and he just hit a grand slam, you know. And they did that, and they got a lot of trouble for it. So that was one of the things I can mention. But anyway, we absolutely. I wish I could get a hold of that tape. We just saw it once, and they took and edited it to where it looked more even sided. Like we had a lot of comebacks for him, which they deleted. You know, one of them was, he was talking about, how this song is just encourages the wrong things in young people. And I said, well, what about songs of your day, Mr. McLennan? Like, the birds do it, bees do it. What were they talking about, do you think? Cut that out?
you long-haired punks. You bunch of punks. No, I said they treat you like a bunch of long-haired punks and just keep you little kids in your place.
So anyway, we massacred them, but that's history, you know.
Right.
Just the way things happen, you know. And from then on, we just Dick left the group again, and you know. We kind of Ed Cobb got so full of himself; he was really difficult to communicate with and difficult to work with, and so our manager talked us into leaving him and his company, Greengrass, who we were signed with.
Right.
And they in turn got a hold of Dick, and they said, "You don't need the rest of these guys; you're a star on your own." And he had agreed to all this, you know, and was very favorable about leaving them. So, you know, we're all together, and this the day before we were supposed to do this gig, and of all places, it was at my high school alma mater. We're going to do a concert there, and we get this letter from Dick. He didn't even speak to us in person, saying, "Well, I've decided to go with Ray Harris and them," you know, and it was just. Broke my heart, you know.
Oh man,
that he would do that, and because they promised him the moon, and they made an album, and it was terrible. I thought instead of capitalizing on his wonderful voice and the raunchy nature of it, you know, they had him almost doing pop songs and country songs. In fact, I think it was recorded in Atlanta, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
And
so they tried to turn him into a pop star. They tried to turn him into a teen idol.
Yeah, yeah. And it just didn't happen. And so we were forced to, you know, change over. And I had, by then, you know, lost a lot of my confidence in singing. And fortunately gained it all back.
Sure.
All the hits now, but we had various people in it and in the group. It just never seemed to work out, you know.
Yeah, you had Lowell George for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, I was going to get to that. Lowell was in the Mothers of Invention.
Right.
And he's very, very gifted musically. He played sitar and was just a great musician, but he absolutely hated the Standells, although he didn't say it. And it was John was a good friend of his, and he brought him into it, you know. And then he started trying to take over the group, you know, and I was the leader of the group, and we started getting in fights, and it just wasn't working out. What he wanted us to do was to grease our hair back, Sha-na-na.
Oh man!
And be like a doo-wop group. And in his mind, that was going back to our roots. We were never a greaser group, you know. But we've parted ways with Lowell, and we just never seemed to catch on to anything. We eventually split the group up in latter part of 69.
Right. And then the 21st century happens, and here we are. And like I said, I saw you in 09, at the Nuggets show at Amoeba.
Yeah.
Right? And it was you and Keith Allison and the Peanut Butter Conspiracy and P.F. Sloan and I think Jackie DeShannon. And I mean that configuration of the Standells, which is admittedly the only one I've ever seen live, just was everything I hoped it would be. You know, I mean, in the greatest complimentary sense, you punched me right in the face, and it was so good. Can you tell me about the lineup that was there and the lineup that you have now?
Yeah, well, it's almost exactly the same. The only person we changed was the guitarist. Paul Downing. He was with an earlier version of the Standells back in the late 69, right before we broke up. He was with us. And then I call him to be a part of this, and he I won't say why, but it just didn't work out.
Right.
But otherwise, it's the same group. John Fleck is in it, and you know what a great bass player he is.
Yeah.
Greg Burnham, who is a terrific drummer. I mean, he teaches drums. Probably one of the best drummers I've ever worked with.
He was so good, man. I was watching the film from that this morning, prepping for this interview, and Burnham was just so good.
Yeah, he really was. He just picks right up on things. And one of the nicest, most mellow guys, especially for a drummer, that I've ever worked with. And, you know, you give him suggestions. He's, oh, okay. Yeah, that sounds cool, you know. And I really like that. And I really like that about the group, you know, the guitarist we have now, who's been with us since Paul left is probably one of the best guitarists I've ever worked with, Mark Adrian.
Okay.
He auditioned for the group, and because of our experience with Paul, we really put these guys to the ringer who are auditioning for us. And Mark was one that just came back every time. You know, he was with almost a glam rock group that were big and they were huge in Europe. And they never made it in the States, but just a nice guy and tremendously talented. And like I said, one of the best guitarists I've ever worked with, and he's a great singer. So we had during the auditions, I would give him Standells phrasings and how to sing. You know, how the Standells have a certain way of doing songs,
it's half
singing and half talking. We probably invented rap back then. I don't know. a lot of it was phrasing, and he picked up on it, and he came back, and he got the job, and I got to say, I've never been more happy with somebody than I have with Mark. He's just, he does some of the lead singing. I do most of it, but he does, you know, some of the lead singing, and people just love him. He puts on a show on the stage, and his guitar playing is beyond everything I've ever heard.
And so this incarnation of the Standells, you've cut two new albums. You did a tour in 2014.
Yeah.
And the Dirty Water Tour is coming up.
Yeah.
So tell me.
Well, last year we did the, you know, national tour. We did like 16 cities across the nation. And then we also did a big show in Italy, in Parma at this big festival there, and then a big festival in San Diego. And this year we were kind of holding off for this release of our second album. We had one that came out last year called Bump.
Right.
And we were determined to make it as though the Standells never quit recording, if you know what I mean.
Of course.
As recognizable as the Standells, and yet it's taking the Standells from where they were back in the 60s and bringing them up to today. And each song kind of, you know, was more advanced than the others, you know.
Did you record digitally or did you use?
We recorded on, we were going to record it on tape, but we built our own garage studio. And it's in a garage, and we figured, that's our roots. And
right.
And there's just some kind of magic to it where you can go into this junky place and be relaxed, not have to worry about the clock. And if you come up with creative ideas, you know, you can try them right there or not, or come back and redo them. So that's what we decided. I'm also a recording engineer, a Pro Tools engineer.
Right.
So I did all the engineering on it, and I produced it. And we did it all there as a family. We brought nobody else in. And although people will swear that we did, I mean, there's one song where there was a call for a sax solo on it. And I did all the sax solo on my keyboard. And you listen, it's the theme song, Bumpin' the Night. And we've had sax players that come in and say, man, that is a good sax solo. You know, it's because I've been around long enough to know about how a lot of these people think. If I play a guitar on the synthesizer, then it's a guitar. It's not a keyboardist playing a guitar,
right.
You know. So that's why I think. And I put in a lot of the trills and the riffs that the sax players use. And it's fooled a lot of people, but I'll be honest, it's me playing the keyboard because we stuck to our word. We didn't bring any other musicians to our sessions.
Now, you're using synthesizers, of course, Larry, but, I mean, it's a Standells record, so is there also a full-on real-life Hammond B3 on the record?
No.
Really?
No, it wasn't. It was my keyboard.
Wow.
And I love Hammond B3s, don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But... nowadays with keyboards, they have certain sound samples that you cannot tell the difference. You cannot tell the difference. And we even recorded, we started recording in a studio up in San Francisco, and, they did have a Hammond B3 up there. And actually the sound I got in this thing was more like a B3 than that was.
If it's good enough for you, it's good enough for me.
So, it's hard to explain, but, it does have the rotating Leslie sounds on it, and,
right.
And it has all of that, and that's what I used, you know, and, so it is what it is, you know, but the first album was the Standells, you know, taking it from, you know, the earlier rock stuff. I did one song called Mr. 1%, for instance. It's just it's straight rock and roll, and it's really a take on the a slam at the wealthiest 1%. And the Standells represent the working class back in the 60s. A lot of people call us a working class group. You know, why pick on me? Sometimes good guys don't wear white.
Good guys don't wear white. Yeah, that's the song that came to mind was Good Guys Don't Wear White.
And we were, and we did two songs on the album. This one, Mr. 1%, is really slamming the wealthiest 1%, but in a comic type of manner. And the next one I can't think of a name. My mind has slipped. But it is also a little more advanced in the arrangement part of it. And it also is a protest song. And, you know, I should know it because I co-wrote it. And that's something.
So there's this album. There's the next one that's on the shelves and about to be released. Is that right? The second album?
No, it's actually been released. It was released in May.
Okay.
And, it's on Sony Music, and it is a live recording we've done. We did it in Chicago last year. And this is the neat thing, again, about digital recording, is they had Pro Tools equipment in there, so they recorded the whole thing on Pro Tools on my hard drive. I took it with me, and then we got it back and just mixed it. And, I mean, it's raunchy. It's the Standells as they are, which, again, we're pretty much like we are in the recordings.
Right.
You know, people accused us of using a lot of techniques and things in our recordings, which we did not. It's just us being us, you know. I'm doing all the most of the lead singing now, but all, you know, I, you know, back in the old days, people had problems distinguishing between Dick's voice and mine. We sounded pretty much similar.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that I'm carrying off, as you know, that Dick passed away.
Right.
A
couple of years ago.
Yeah. And also, Gary Lane passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Gary was a very good friend. So, this is something that, I started the group, and I'm finishing with the group, as long as it takes me to, to keep on going, as long as I can keep on going and rocking on stage. And nowadays, I don't just stand behind the keyboard and sing. I actually get out into the audience, and we have another keyboardist that comes up during some of the songs and takes over while I go out into the audience. So I'm out there dancing and jumping around like a 16-year-old.
which brings me to the Dirty Water tour that you're putting together. Tell me about the new tour.
It's been my idea to do this for quite some time, is to put together a tour like the Happy Together tour, but more in the vein of garage rock. And so we came up, our agent, Mike Copley, and they came up with this idea, to put together this big tour of garage rock groups or performers. And then I came up with the idea of the Dirty Water Tour. So we've got it out to, just about everybody. And it looks like it's going to start happening probably the latter part of the year into 2016. It takes a long time to book these shows, because most of the big venues, they book for the year,
right.
In January. I have no doubt, we have just some great artists on it. I'm just really thrilled that we have Mitch Ryder on it. Mitch Ryder, the Detroit Wheels.
Sure.
I love Mitch. And Gary DiCarlo, who is the actual singer of Na Na Hey Hey, Kissing Goodbye.
Right, from Steam.
Yeah. And there's a lot of scuttlebutt about that. That it was a studio musician. He actually sang it. And his record company, put together another group to go out and tour. But he was the one that sang it, and he is quite a performer. Just the way things were back then.
Right.
Sometimes you have bad experiences like that.
Sure.
And Gary is just an incredible performer. We've got some tapes on it. We do have a Facebook page, the Dirty Water Tour. And he is just a great performer. And then we've got Johnny Eccles, of In Love. Now we can Johnny Eccles and R. John Fleck and Arthur Lee formed the original Love.
When they were the Grassroots?
No, after the Grassroots.
Okay.
I think John came into it. They went through several different name changes back
right.
then. John could tell you more about that. But it was the three of them that came up with Love.
With Love. What a band.
It. And John was actually on some of the early recordings. So it's really the two Johns that will be performing on the tour together that are Love, There's nobody else around except, I think, the drummer is still around.
Right.
Anyway, there's Johnny, who's just a great guy. I love Johnny, and what an incredible guitarist he is too. And he does sing, and then we also have Jimmy Soames of The Shadows of Night.
Oh, wow!
It is just a dynamite show. Jimmy is. I don't know if you've seen him perform, but he is just a great performer.
How's his voice now?
It's great. He's never lost it. He never lost it. He's still doing Gloria like he did back, back then.
Gotta love it.
And he's a great showman. And he's, again, just a wonderful guy to be around. He's my buddy. He appeared with us at our record release party at the Satellite.
Right.
And he got up as our guest in Santa Gloria. And so, I mean, it's just a power-packed show. And it's the first of its kind, really, that's featuring garage rock artists, you know, at least up-tempo artists. It differs from the Happy Together tour in the fact that you know, we don't have the cow cells. We probably never will. I don't mean that derogatory.
Not at all. No, I absolutely get it. And I hear the respect, too.
But we'll have this as a yearly variety show, and it'll go out, and it'll have, you know, mostly people that fit into that, the garage rock category. And I don't know, if you go to our Facebook page,
yeah,
you'll see our poster. And I created the poster, actually.
There you go.
Altador Business. So it's at the top, it says Garage Rock Spectacular.
Right.
And it shows, you know, it has pictures of everybody that's on the tour and their biggest hit songs. And at the bottom it says Dirty Water Tour, you know. And, you know, we sent this out to, or our agent has sent this out to all the promoters. We're getting great feedback.
Fantastic.
And like I said, we'll just a lot of people that want to do it, just nobody's signed on the dotted line yet.
It's the Dirty Water Tour on Facebook.
Yeah.
And, you know, now that you guys are out and out and about again, and you used to look out in the audience and see all this shaggy, shaggy hair, and now you look out and you see a lot of gray and you see a lot of skin, you know, tell me about the crowd at a Standells show in 2015. What's it like?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, we've had a lot of young people that have been at our shows. You know, a lot of, you know, millennials have been, and teenagers. And they're picking up on the music for the first time, you know, in the 60s. And they're saying, wow, this stuff was really good.
Yep.
You know, it doesn't have a bunch of synthesizers in it. It's not hip-hop, and you know, it's not programmed. It's actually people, you know, doing their music and doing it well. And so we get quite a few young people. I got a funny story, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Last year, we were on our tour. One of the last places we performed was in Denver at this club there, and did a great show. And afterwards, I was signing autographs for this 20-something year old girl, and on her jacket, you know, and which I thought was cool. Well, you know, we used to do that back in the 60s. and other things too, but
of course.
And so I finished signing her jacket, you know, and she turned around and grabbed me and laid the biggest kiss on me. And here this girl, and I was old enough, you know, I'm old enough to be her grandfather, you know, and you know, I am humbled. I am absolutely humbled.
And that, my friend, is why we pick up a guitar when we're 16 years old.
Yeah.
Or keyboards, yeah,
fact,
or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, when we did the Ponderosa, that was back in 2013. They have a big show out there. We headlined there.
Right.
And they had a... press kit beforehand,
right?
And they were asking, you know, some of the groups, you know, why they formed and everything. And one of the guys was honest. He says, you know, I never got laid until I picked up a guitar. And so. It's just the name of the game back then, you know. And of course, I look back on it now saying, God, you know, did I do all those things? They were crazy times, and you learn from it, you know.
I would imagine. Larry, this has been fantastic. Thank you very much. I'd love to have you back to tell some more stories about touring with the Stones and stuff like that.
I could go on all night.
Believe me, I know you could, and nothing would make me happier, but you know.
The Rolling Stones tour in and of itself could be all night.
There you go.
Anyway, love to be back, and thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Of course, my friend. Like I said, it's a privilege. Like I said, I discovered the Standells, 15 years after you broke up, and I got it. So I understand the kids that are picking it up today, because everybody has felt like a Standell. I absolutely get it. Thank you so much.
I got one closing remark.
Yeah, man.
I was reading Twitter, and he says, this guy said, I see a lot of stray Standells around. And I'm going, what? And that's what I did. I posted on Twitter, what? He says, I'm in London. He says, a lot of these kids are walking around the streets with long hair. They look just like the Standells.
You gotta love it.
That's it.
You gotta love it. Well, my friend, when you're in, when the next time you're playing in L.A., I absolutely will be a part of it. If you ever find yourself in the neck of the woods, come into the studio, and we'll raise an elbow and tell more war stories. And
I appreciate your knowledge too. You have a great knowledge of that era, and that's really terrific.
You guys were my gateway drug, let me tell you. Really appreciate it. Look forward to seeing the tour.
All right, yeah.
And I'm around if you need anything else, Larry. Thank you so much.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.